Any session on climate change always pulls a big crowd at this festival. But this one links tobacco with the controversy over climate science. So keep listening to find out that connection. It's called You Have Been Warned, and the presenter is Sam Mostyn.
Many of you may recall that it was about this time last year, right here, that the Sydney Writers' Festival convened the emergency town hall meeting on climate change. We were dealing with a panel of eminent climate scientists, economists and activists. It was a really tough night. It was full of stories of missed opportunities, attacks on scientists and the scientific method, predictions of weather catastrophes, food security challenges and the problems with our economy in the years ahead. Tonight, we're returning to the topic of climate change, but with a different focus and a different panel of writers drawn from very diverse backgrounds, experiences and expertise. And our aim tonight is that you don't leave here feeling depressed and miserable, but that we're going to lift your knowledge, your spirits, your sights. We're going to rise above defeatism and consider the powerful role that we all have to play in responding to this most wicked of problems. The questions guiding our conversation tonight will centre on how we get the action most of us know we need, while the political discourse remains mired in confusion, fear and inaction. We have a wonderful panel tonight, comprising our United States guests Kurt Steiger and Naomi Oreskes, and our homegrown Paul Gilding. We've decided to have a conversational session this evening rather than formal presentations, and our writers have been very keen to leave you a considerable time for your questions so that you can enter that conversation. Let me now introduce our wonderful writers to you. Closest to me is Kurt Steiger. Kurt is a paleoclimatologist, ecologist and science journalist with a PhD in biology and geology from Duke University. Kurt has published widely on climate and ecology in both major scientific journals, including Science, and for popular audience in National Geographic and Adirondack Life. He teaches at Paul Smith's College in upstate New York and holds a research associate post at the University of Maine's Climate Change Institute. But it is the depth and breadth of his background in the natural sciences which defines the quality of his insights. His work takes him from the ecological history of Africa and its lakes to the bat pollination of flowers on the South Pacific Islands of Melanesia to modern climate change in northeastern United States. Now, Kurt thinks in huge slabs of time. His short term is in centuries. His longer term is in the hundreds of thousands and millions of years, and he thinks a lot about what happens to everything over the longest periods of time. When he's not immersed in ice ages and interglacial periods, you can find him on YouTube performing on his banjos and guitars. His most recent book is Deep Future, The Next 100,000 Years of Life on Earth. His book raises many new things for us to consider, well beyond the time frames that we often work within. Please welcome Kurt. Naomi Oreskes is a geologist, science historian, teacher and writer. Naomi is Professor of History and Science Studies at the University of California, San Diego, and she studied geology at Stanford University, where she was awarded her PhD. She is a prize-winning writer, and in 2004, her essay, The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change, led to significant editorial pieces in US newspapers and was cited in congressional testimony in the US Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Only last week, unsurprisingly, Naomi was named as the 2011 Climate Change Communicator of the Year by George Mason University's Centre for Climate Change Communication. Indeed. Her book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, is a masterful historical review of the institutional forces that developed into the climate change denial movement and traces their origins and actors to the tobacco and acid rain debates in the United States over many decades. Her book, Merchants of Doubt, was published in 2010 and has just been released in paperback. Welcome, Naomi. Paul Gilding will be well known to many of you. He's an independent writer, advisor, long-term activist and advocate for action on climate change and sustainability. Unlike our other panellists, Paul is not a scientist, but has spent his life immersed in the world of environmentalism and activism and has always put himself at the front line of the issues he cares about. At one stage, unknown to many of you, he also served in the Australian Air Force. He served as the CEO of Greenpeace International in 1992, the first Australian and youngest person ever to serve in that position. From the lessons learned in global environmental activism, Paul turned his skills to assisting global corporations with their understanding and engagement with the emerging sustainability issues. He did so bravely, deciding to embrace his former enemies and discover the place of business in this debate. His work was conducted through his own company, Ecos Corporation, and he went on to found his own innovative eco business, Easy Being Green. Paul serves on many NGOs and is on the faculty of the Prince of Wales Business and Environment Program at Cambridge University. The Great Disruption is Paul's first book and boldly predicts that the one big idea humanity has been relentlessly pursuing over the last several hundred of years, that of economic growth, is dead, or at least on its last legs, and that we have some very big choices ahead. Please welcome our entire panel. Kurt, let's start with you. You've got the huge picture to share with us. You're very comfortable in considering the world's huge blocks of geological times and epochs. In your book, you promote the idea that our current chapter of history qualifies as a new age, the age of humans, or the Anthropocene epoch, or Anthropocene epoch, depending on how you like to say things. Can you explain to us the idea of the human age or the Anthropocene and how the consideration of a much longer time frame is going to help us make better decisions in the short term? And from your book, what are the kind of options that you are advocating for us at this time?
Sure. Basically, while the general public has sort of been misled in a lot of ways that the climate science community is divided as to our role in making climate change now, the folks actually doing the research have been moving along and finding out some very interesting things. And just the idea that we could change climate in such a significant way for such long time periods, in addition to the other impacts we have as well, such as wiping out other species, putting our pollutants around, changing landscapes, changing the chemistry of the oceans. These changes are so large and so incontrovertible from the scientific evidence that it's basically just considered fact to the point that we've made up a name for it. Several people have apparently come up with it at the same time, actually, too. It's basically equivalent to the way we've been blocking off the history of the Earth into little segments based on what was around or what environmental changes happened. So we'd have the Pleistocene epoch and the Eocene epoch and things like that. So taking that pattern and using the same kind of terminology, the scientific community has sort of organically come up with this concept of saying, in addition to the age of dinosaurs, the age of mammals, we are now in the age of humans, where we're so numerous, our technology is so powerful, and we're so interconnected that we've become a force of nature. So this term follows in that tradition, and it's called the Anthropocene or Anthropocene epoch, translates to the age of humans. Now, it's actually an important thing to put a name on that because it forces us to draw attention to it and see our place in the big picture. And what I've tried to do and what a growing group of climate scientists have started to do is to sort of put our place on a large time scale and how do we fit into the big picture of what this Anthropocene epoch is going to be like. And basically what we're finding out by simply asking where the carbon dioxide goes after it leaves our tailpipes and smokestacks, we basically find, first of all, it goes mostly to the oceans, and what the oceans can't take up, reactions with rocks and soils will do. But the mind-boggling thing is the time scales involved in this. These are very slow natural processes, and rather than taking just a few centuries or a few thousand years, this is going to take tens of thousands of years to clean up by these slow processes. So in the first blush of realizing this, it could actually be kind of overwhelming. I had an emotional response to it when I saw the effects of our climatic impacts now are going to be lasting long enough to interfere with future ice ages, which are the things I'm used to studying in the past. But I want to follow that immediately by saying we do have some choices to make. We should face the fact that we've already set changes in motion where we're going to have a steep warming, a rapid turnaround that I call a climate whiplash when we eventually do start to recover, and then a long, slow recovery lasting at least 100,000 years. And that's what happens if we do the right thing, which is switch quickly away from fossil fuels in the next few decades as quickly as we can. Now, that can be depressing to say we've already made this stuff happen. Why don't we just give up now and jump off a cliff? You can do that if you want, but we really shouldn't, because we have an important decision to make. If we don't do that right thing, which we should also do for other reasons besides climate, If we burn through all of our fossil fuel reserves, especially including the coal reserves, the effects of our changes will be many times more severe and long-lasting. So the warming will be much greater, we'll lose all the ice on the Earth, and the recovery could take 500,000 years. And the most amazing thing that sort of wrapped this up for me, to turn this from a paralyzing doom and gloom story to a motivating thing, was that the choice between those two options, the moderate and the extreme path, is actually in our hands. It's going to happen in the next few decades or during this century, and the decision will be made by people who are alive on the Earth today. So while we may have often thought we're just one little cog in the giant machine or just one population in the grand sweep of human history, this is an unusually important pivotal time that we are in. And so just the fact that we can affect climate that far in the future demonstrates, at least to me, and I hope to other people, the power of our capability of changing the Earth on that scale. So we really do have the power to make that choice.
And I know you believe that to be a very strong ethical matter for us. It's not a philosophical matter, and we mustn't confuse this issue of these exceedingly long periods of time and the impact. We mustn't think of that as theoretical. That's real. And the decisions we take today will have these extraordinary effects.
Yes.
Over a much longer period of time. Mm-hmm. And that's an ethical issue for humanity today.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've had these kinds of changes naturally in the past, somewhat comparably, but because we are changing them, by definition, there's an ethical component to
it. So there's a consequence to the Anthropocene epic. Yeah. Naomi, if I could bring you in now. Your book, I love detective stories, and your book is one of the greatest detective stories around, I think. It's a fascinating history of how scientific consensus was completely undermined by a small group of scientists, mostly physicists, supported by particular institutions and think tanks. It's been an enormously successful strategy, from tobacco through acid rain, ozone layer, and then now to global warming more generally. And lots of people today, there may be people in the audience, still don't know what the scientific consensus is and still think there's doubt. And the peddling of doubt is what you write about so brilliantly and you trace. So in light of the fact that as a scientist you've discovered this trace of doubt and the seeding of doubt, what hope have we got as humans to do as Kurt has asked us to do, which is to make decisions based on consensus and do it rapidly and do it with a sense of confidence?
Yeah, not a lot.
I was hoping to keep you up for a while.
Well, yeah, you know, it was interesting writing this book because I think in a way we oscillated between optimism and pessimism. But most of the time, the emotion we had writing the book was simply one of just being stunned, just absolutely stunned. And my co-author, Eric Conway, and I, you know, he's in Pasadena, I'm in San Diego, so we're not too far apart, but we're working in different places. We would sometimes call each other up on the telephone and say, you won't believe what I found today, you know? And you couldn't make this stuff up, you know? And if you did make it up, nobody would believe it. People would say, oh, this is a preposterous story, right? The only thing that makes it believable is the fact that it's true, that these things actually happened. So exactly, as you say, this is a story about a really remarkable series of events over the course of half a century that were designed, deliberately and consciously designed, to confuse people about a whole set of issues. And in the book, we tell the story of how this strategy had a beginning. It actually had an origin. I was telling Kurt earlier, when you're a historian, you know, you want to write narrative. You want to tell stories about the past, but true stories. But it's always a challenge to figure out where the story begins, because in history, you know, everything is related to everything else and there's no real beginning. Well, historians often say the beginnings are just arbitrary. But actually, this story has a real beginning. And it's a day in 1953 when a major study had come out at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Research Institute in New York City that really showed definitively that the tars in tobacco caused cancer. The experiment was with laboratory mice. Scientists painted the skin of the mice with tobacco tars, and lo and behold, every single one of those mice got cancer in the place where the tars had been painted on their skin. This piece of scientific work got a lot of media attention. It was written up in the Reader's Digest. Reader's Digest headline was, "Cancer by the Carton." So this was serious bad news for the tobacco industry, and they knew it. And they were the ones who basically viewed this as a crucial experiment. And so the leading CEOs of the major tobacco companies in the United States met in the Plaza Hotel in New York City to decide what to do about this. And the decision they made, And, you know, sometimes people accuse us of, you know, this is a conspiracy theory, right? Well, it's not a theory. This is what actually happened. These men sat down and were later found guilty by the U.S. Department of Justice for a criminal conspiracy under the law in the United States of America. They decided that they would fight the scientific evidence by fostering doubt. And the strategy they developed, we call it the tobacco strategy, we call it doubt mongering, was to say, well, we don't really know. Science is very complicated. You know, cancer is a very complicated disease. There are many different things that cause cancer. You know, you never know what caused any one particular person's cancer. And we need to study this more. We need to do more research. And of course, it's a brilliant strategy. It's brilliantly evil because it's true. We don't know what causes any one cancer. And cancer is a complicated disease. And even today, the mechanisms of cancer are not entirely understood. But yet, despite all those uncertainties, the scientific evidence also showed that even though, yes, it's true, there are many other things that cause cancer, tobacco does cause cancer. That was not uncertain. So the idea was to undermine the certainty by distracting attention with all of these other issues. And so what we show in the book is that this strategy was very effective for the tobacco industry. I mean, here we are in Australia today, still arguing about whether or not, you know, the tobacco industry should be allowed to have advertising on the packages, right? 60 years later, we are still arguing about this. So it was very effective, and because it was so effective, people realized that it could be applied to other stories as well. And so in the book, we tell the story of how a group of men picked up this strategy, some of whom had worked directly for the tobacco industry, and began to apply it to a whole series of issues, starting with nuclear winter, moving through acid rain, as you said, the ozone hole, and then ultimately the biggest environmental question of all, the issue that really is the one that's controlling the future of humanity, the question of global warming.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Naomi Oreskes at the Sydney Writers' Festival session called You Have Been Warned.
There were a number of startling discoveries we made in this book. One of them was the connection, you know, being able to trace global warming all the way back to tobacco. And the other was the incredibly small number of people involved initially. Now, over time, as the story unfolds, we see more people getting involved. We see more think tanks and institutions taking up the cause. We see the fossil fuel industry getting involved. But it's interesting that the story doesn't begin with the fossil fuel industry. They come on board later. Other regulated industries, the chemical industry, becomes involved. So we see it grow. We see how the network expands. And we tell the story of this growth and expansion. But the remarkable thing is tracing it back initially to a group of three men, as you said, all physicists, none of whom were climate scientists, none of whom were oncologists or epidemiologists. They were actually nuclear physicists and solid-state physicists who had come to prominence during the Cold War, had worked on Cold War weapons and rocketry programs, had helped build the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb, build the American space program. And of course, this was crucial to answering a key question in the story, was how did these three men have so much impact? Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, we know that individuals can have impact. You know, we know that a single great leader like Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King can have a positive impact on the world. We're a little reluctant to think that a handful of not-so-great people can have such a powerful negative impact. But we show how these men did have tremendous impact because they appeared to be credible, because they were scientists of a sort, and because they had access to power because of the work they had done in the Cold War.
And we'll come back to it in a moment, but they also had a very strong ideological platform, right, which had nothing to do with the environment or tobacco or acid rain. So we'll return to that in a moment after Paul's had a chance to chat with us. Paul, we're going to move away from the science for a little bit. Your thesis, and it's a big, big thesis, is that the one big idea that humans have about our economics is economic growth. Mm-hmm. That we have to grow, we have to continue to grow, that the end of growth is terrible for all of us. You say that growth, economic growth as a model and as a fact, is dead, dying, or close to it, or now on life support. So if economic growth is dead, what happens now?
Look, it is the big question, and it does go into this, both these points about very long-term trends and how we behave as a society and as a people. And I think the first thing to say is that, as I say, as the opening line of the book, is the earth is full. Now, the earth is full is not just a rhetorical line, it's actually a physical state, that the earth is full of our economy, full of us, and full of what we're doing. And that is showing extreme signs in terms of the impacts of that globally, you know, scientists are telling us what's happening on the climate, but also on land degradation, on water supplies and a whole range of issues. We're kind of operating at or past the sustainable capacity of the Earth, right? And when I do my PowerPoint presentation, it's this. Now, the Earth is this big, the economy is that big, and we're squeezing it inside the Earth, right? So we're operating under pressure. Now, that would possibly be manageable, but the reason I say that economic growth is dead is because we're operating at that capacity now, and we plan via economic growth to go to 300 or 400% bigger than that. So some would say that's a problem. I say it's not a problem because it's not going to happen, right? And it's not going to happen because it would have to defy the laws of physics and chemistry to do that.
The physics guys helping on this one.
Yeah, well, there isn't enough land, there isn't enough air, there isn't enough water. You just can't grow an economy like that. So the good news is it's not going to happen. The bad news is that it's the only idea we had, right, about society and how to move forward. So if the one idea we've got is fundamentally broken and that concept is finished, we need to start thinking about that, and very deeply and very quickly, because there's a very, very big difference, you know, in the theory on this area between a failed growth economy and a steady state economy. So you can design an economy to fit in the Earth. We can do this in a way that, and we know what that looks like and how to do it, but if we need to plan for that crisis that's coming, and we need to get ready for that state so we move into that steady state economy in a more constructive way. Now, the reason that's so important is because of all that we've heard from here is about denial and avoidance of reality, right? So what do we do to avoid facing reality? We're very good at avoiding reality. We're good at it personally, we're good at it corporately, we're good at it, you know, at the national and global scale in recent times in particular. So what that means is denial will continue for some time yet about what I'm saying about the end of economic growth. No one, I've just spent 8 weeks travelling the world on this issue, and surprisingly few people said, your basic theory is wrong. They said, look, I don't think it's going to happen that fast. I think we've got a few decades to think about it. I think it might unfold in a different way. I'm sure we can respond more quickly, etc. But people are no longer questioning, which is a relief, the basic physics that you can't fit a four-planet economy on the Earth, right? So that's sort of good news as well, but people are facing up to it. But we won't change. We won't change until the crisis hits. And the reason I sort of have increasing urgency around getting ready for the crisis is because that's the opportunity for change. That's the point where we get a lot of leverage and a lot of potential for a dramatic shift in the human society and economy, which we'll come back to. And if we're not ready for that, they will miss the opportunity. And a good crisis should never be wasted, but a crisis this big sure as hell shouldn't be wasted. Mm.
We're going to come back to this issue about the breaking of the capitalism model or the amending of it. Before we do that, I just thought it would be interesting for the audience to know and to pick up on Naomi's comments about science scepticism and the deniers, and point out that there is actually a process that scientists go through to overcome their own natural scepticism, which is part of being a scientist. And one of our scientists here this evening, Kurt, up until about a decade ago, was a climate science sceptic. Because of the work he was doing and what he still needed to see. I thought it would be interesting for you to hear what Kurt went through and why he then became a believer in climate science. And it speaks to Naomi's comment about how the evidence is important. Mm. Kurt, do you want to share that one?
Yeah. I call myself a climate skeptic sort of tongue-in-cheek because the choice of terms is really important here. And to be a scientist is to be a skeptic. You basically say, I'm not going to try to go by my biases and my emotions and just by hearsay, but what the evidence actually says. And with my background as a climate historian, studying changes in the sun's energy and the coming and going of ice ages, when I was hearing about the modern global warming happening, my first response was, well, what's the big deal? I'm more worried about a mile thick sheet of ice bulldozing all of Canada. And it also wasn't perfectly clear yet that what was happening was not part of a natural cycle, which is something that now the deniers are grabbing onto, that kind of idea, and not letting go of it. Well, it's a legitimate question to raise at first. And we had a relatively recent global cooling several centuries ago. We called it the Little Ice Age, and part of the recovery could well be that. So I was skeptical then when people were saying it was due to us. And another common argument was that it's happening quicker than it ever happened. And my colleagues working with annually layered ice cores and tree ring records had shown that that was not the case. We've had rapid climate changes in the past, too. So I was saying, well, you know, okay, my friend Bill McKibben here wants me to join in on that. I'm not so sure yet. And some other scientists had moved ahead and said it was due to humans. My sort of a road to Damascus moment, I guess, came roughly a decade ago when several papers came out, peer-reviewed, good, solid bookkeeping science, and they asked the basic question, what makes global climate change? It's the energy coming out of the sun, which is something I was used to studying. It's the volcanoes and the dust in the air, and it's greenhouse gases, nothing else. Well, we know that the sun's natural cycles are not doing anything unusual in the last 30 or 40 years. We've been observing it, and it's in my kind of paleoclimate records. The volcanoes aren't all of a sudden doing their thing unusually. The greenhouse gases are going up because we've been measuring them, and the temperature's been going up. So basically, by process of elimination, case is closed. And when I saw those data in graphic form and peer-reviewed, I said, yep, okay, that does it. And I told Bill McKibben, he was very happy to hear that. And he said, well, you know, why don't you look at what's going on in upstate New York where you live? And, okay, I started pulling together the climate records, and at first I didn't see much. But when I got the good data together, sure enough, there's the warming trend picking up in the last 30 years right where I live. So now where I had previously been bashed by my environmentalist friends for not being alarmist enough, suddenly when I started publishing things that showed that the ice cover on the lakes where I live is 2 weeks shorter every year than it was a century ago, now I'm getting hate mail from the climate deniers. So I figure I'm doing my job as a good climate skeptic.
Well, it's a good thing to remember, though, because we often hear about natural variability as one of the great defences to what's really going on. And for someone with your experience and your incredible long-term view, you know about natural variability. You've got the data.
Absolutely. But that's what Naomi was saying. That's why it's so effective, because there really is natural variability.
Yes.
And it will keep happening. And it's just that it's not what's going on right now.
Yeah, yeah. Naomi, you heard Paul talk about the fact that we've got to change this economic system. It's a reformed form of capitalism. It's not quite socialism, and it's not communism, but communism and socialism and regulation was what these guys were really most worried about when they started their campaigns against good quality evidence-based science and the call for change. Do you want to talk us through a bit about the ideology that was driving this and what you discovered in your research?
Yeah. So when we were writing the book, the big question that was driving us was why? Why would these people do this? Why would distinguished scientists attack the work of their own colleagues? Why would they betray the scientific community that they dedicated their lives to and betray the scientific process that they had dedicated their lives to? And what connected all these seemingly very diverse issues? I mean, what does climate change have to do with tobacco? You know, what does acid rain have to do with nuclear winter? Well, there's a little connection there. But, you know, these were really, really different issues, and no one could possibly be an expert on all of these diverse issues. So we wanted to answer that question, and we thought that if we could explain that, then it would go a long way to explaining why we had been stuck in this impasse. And so what we were able to discover reading their own works, reading what they had said, articles they had published, was that it really came out of their Cold War experience, and it came out of their deeply held anti-communism and their belief that they had worked hard. Their whole life's work was really dedicated to protecting the United States against the Soviet threat, as they understood it. And I think the meaning of their life was actually found in the work they had done in the Cold War. When the Cold War ended, you know, the timing of this is coincidental but very important. So these men founded the George C. Marshall Institute in 1984, a date that I find very ironic. And it was all about defending Strategic Defense Initiative, defending Ronald Reagan's concept of a winnable nuclear war. But then the Cold War ended, rather unexpectedly, right? Not that many people predicted it. And they found themselves without an enemy. And so it's sort of like generals who can't stop fighting the last war. So they found a new enemy, and the new enemy was environmentalists. So why environmentalists? Well, because at that time, this is the late 1980s, this is around the time that there's big discussions taking place about the ozone hole, acid rain. Well, most environmentalists were calling for regulation. They were calling for the government to step in and intervene in the marketplace and do something about what was essentially a market failure. And the fear they had, the anxiety they had, was that if you accept that, if you accept that the government needs to intervene in the capitalist system, in the marketplace, that you will be on the slippery slope to socialism. That first you regulate acid rain, as we like to say, today tobacco, tomorrow the Bill of Rights. And although it seems ridiculous, and in a way it was ridiculous, it was a kind of, you know, reductio ad absurdum, and yet, you know, you can begin to see their argument. It's the fear of the loss of personal liberty, the encroaching, the nanny state, which then becomes a socialist state, which then becomes a totalitarian state. And they frequently cited Friedrich Hayek, the Austrian neoliberal economist, about the road to serfdom. So effectively, regulation is the road to serfdom. And so that became the kind of driving ideological justification that in their own minds justified challenging the science, questioning the science, in order to prevent what they saw as a kind of overweening, encroaching government control of our lives. And there's this one particular quote that, for me, kind of really summed this up, when one particular scientist, someone you know, Fred Singer, said, and he was defending tobacco, he was defending secondhand smoke, and I'm reading this stuff and I'm thinking, how can someone defend a product, and this was after the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency had written a big report in which they documented the scientific evidence that secondhand smoke causes cot death. And I thought, how can someone defend a product that kills infants in their cribs? But Fred Singer answered that question in his own words. He said, if we don't control the government's attempt to regulate dangers, then there's no limit to what the government can do to control our lives. So there it is.
Yeah. So we're back to this Anthropocene issue about the influences on us as human beings and the decisions we take and what we're frightened of, and often irrationally frightened of. Paul, you've got good economists on your side. You cite them in your book over decades who mm-hmm. support the idea that the current economy, just even without the massive growth we've seen, was always doomed to have to move to a different place. But against what you're hearing, particularly from Naomi, about how easily the other side can build defeatism, pessimism, and pretend this isn't happening.
And fear.
And
sort of anxiety about the encroaching government.
Yeah, so, and you call for regulation because this new planned economy does have to have new elements of regulation to save us and to make us better. So what's going to happen? How are humans going to rise in this Anthropocene era?
It's a very interesting context to think about, because in that context, the option was an option. If you like, the choice was we could actually decide which way to go, more or less regulation, more or less change, otherwise we'll be okay. Mm. And otherwise we're on the road to serfdom. The reality is we're now on the road to serfdom, right? Is that the collapse of the global economy, driven by growth going nuts and destroying the global ecosystem, is the road to serfdom. Very hungry serfdom, by the way. And so that is where we're going if we don't intervene. Now, the joy of this situation, if you like, and it's sort of, people always think it's a bit weird when I get accused of being an optimist, given what I'm saying. But it's like, the good news in this is quite strong, and that is that it's not a question of politics anymore, right? We are going to stop growing because we physically can't grow. Therefore, we're going to have to change the economy profoundly or not have one, right? So it's not like it's a choice, and that's a really different situation. So I think we're going to hit the crisis. To answer your question, you know, how this unfolds.
Do you think? Are we
this decade?
This decade?
No, this decade. No, this is no longer.
So it's no longer end of century.
Nah.
It's not mid-century. It's
no,
the end
totally
of this decade.
Not.
Right?
And this is where there is dispute within my kind of little circle of people who focus on this issue. The dispute is it 20 or 30 years or less than 10 years? And but either way, it's our lifetime.
And earlier you said you've been presenting to a lot of people all around the world in boardrooms. When you say end of the decade, do people challenge you, or are they kind of, that's possible?
Certainly challenge, but certainly think it's possible.
Right.
So they don't reject it outright, which I think is pretty scary, because they're not planning for that. Right. So they should be planning for that. If they think that's a 50% chance or a 20% chance, you should be planning for that, because that's a really profound impact, and they're not. And I think that sort of goes to this issue of how we change. So how we change as a society, as individuals, is we wait for the crisis and then we respond. So the crisis is going to come, and then how do we respond to that becomes the issue. And the reason that's important is because that's when we get to design the new economy. And it is going to be, I mean, this is one of the great ironies, I think, in Naomi's stuff around the ideological approach to this, is that capitalism is currently eating itself. Right, is that growth is going to destroy itself. And the Chinese government has said this recently, which I think is really interesting, is they're no longer saying we can't afford to grow this fast or we'll damage the environment. They're now saying we can't afford to grow this fast or growth will be challenged. Right, so they're actually saying we're going to slow down our rate of growth, which is a relative thing from where we are, but we're slowing it down because if we don't slow it down, the impacts of that on ecosystems and on resource supply will make it impossible for us to grow the economy. So they're drawing that connection. Another one recently was Jeremy Grantham, who runs a $100 billion a year investment fund. He's a sort of famous financial guy who's a contrarian about global trends in bubbles and stuff. And he's saying that growth is always going to stop at some point. So this is a major fund manager saying that if we don't slow, if we're not careful, we'll keep on grabbing all of our resources in this relentless pursuit of growth, and then we'll collapse. So that it, now, purely from an economics point of view, there are now many people saying the same thing, which is the crisis will come, and the crisis will force us to change, and getting ready for that is a financial business issue. It's not a question of capitalism or not. Mm. It's a question of catastrophe or not, and then how do we manage that process? And the answer is, of course, is that we have to redesign. Now, I still think it's capitalism, by the way. I don't think it's socialism. I don't think it's communism, right? There is a question mark in my head about democracy surviving the process, but that's another sort of very worrying thing. But markets, you know, markets is a very powerful way of making change happen once you've decided what you want. Right? It's a really crap way of driving change at the beginning. So once we decide collectively what we want, and government then puts a framework around that, markets are very efficient and very effective at delivering that change. And that's it's still markets, it's still capitalism. It's just recognising that, of course, we have limits. Duh.
I mean, it's important to point out, you know, this story that we wrote is just filled with one irony after another. And depending on the day of the week, different ironies strike me as most ironic. But at what we say at the end of the book, of, you know, what we thought was, in fact, the biggest irony of the story was that by delaying action, the merchants of doubt actually increased the likelihood that the very thing they most dreaded would become necessary. Yeah. So we are facing a situation. Thank you. We are facing a situation now where the possibility of extreme government intervention may, in fact, be required. And it's so ironic because, of course, it's not what the vast majority of people ever wanted, including the vast majority of environmentalists.
And you raise in your book a wonderful example about this political issue that sits behind this. Can you tell the story about when you ask what happens when Washington was told about the known impacts over a particular time and what their response was at the time?
Well, see, I like hanging out with Paul because he stops me from being too depressed by my own work. But and again, you know, when we were writing the book, depending upon which particular section we were writing, we were more or less depressed. But I have to say that I do find it a depressing story because, you know, I mean, the title of our session tonight is You've Been Warned, right? And that's really what our story is all about, these repeated warnings told clearly by highly articulate scientists, backed up by enormous amounts of scientific data, and people consistently ignoring the evidence, denying the evidence, I don't want to hear it, it can't really be that bad. And so one of my favorite stories in the book is I interviewed a scientist who was involved in a major 1979 report on climate change, which was distributed at the White House in the United States, the Carter administration, and this scientist was with a group of people briefing the Carter administration officials about this report. So this is 1979, in which they accurately predicted that increased carbon dioxide would lead to detectable climate change by the end of the century, which happened. So one of the officials at the White House asked the scientist, well, when is all of this going to happen? And the scientist said, well, maybe in 40 years. And the official said, get back to me in 39.
Which probably doesn't feel so odd to us here in Australia, thinking about how we're having our current debates. But we're seeing good signs. In the UK, Prime Minister Cameron has announced in recent days a massive shift in the carbon reduction campaign. Now, he's using regulation and getting directly involved in the economy to do that. Does that give you hope that actually he's responding to not just an economic signal, but a human signal about we've got to get on with this?
Look, I think definitely, and I think it's we always forget where we've come from, right? And we kind of lament the fact that there's this really dumb debate happening in Australia about climate change, right? But in actual fact, we're having a debate in Australia about climate change as the most important political issue of the day, right? And that's actually really good progress.
Yeah.
Now we've got a little way to go yet, but the point is. The point is that is really significant, and the fact that we have a Conservative government in the UK, right, who's putting in place amongst the strongest regulation in the world in this area in a democracy. The non-democracies are doing more, but we'll come back to that later. But they're doing that is actually quite significant and quite important because it makes it, it depoliticises the issue.
Yep.
You can't depoliticise it, but that makes it not a left-right issue, but a how-we-do-it issue. And that's where I think we need to get to. So I think those signs are very encouraging. I think the things happening in China are amazingly encouraging in terms of scale of costs coming down in this area. It's just that the science is galloping ahead. Right, and therefore I think we have to face up to the fact that we are going to face this crisis because the response is really good given what we knew 20 years ago.
Whilst the political change might take some time, community activism, community change, give us a sense of what were the most inspiring things you saw along the way.
Amazing things, and this trip I've just done around the world, you know, has really reinforced that. I keep on having people come up to me, you know, after book talks and talking about the incredible things that they're doing on the ground. Right, and radically different ideas and different approaches. I know that one, Natalie's here tonight from the Million Women Campaign, an Australian organisation formed a couple of years ago, now has 40,000 members of people doing practical things about climate change. And that is incredibly appealing to people. I want to go and do something. I want to go and take something that empowers me as opposed to feeling disempowered about the size of the issue. What can I do in a practical sense? So the Million Women Campaign, I think, is a very good example of that. But technology, there's a great company I visited in San Francisco who just said, I want to put solar panels on roofs, but it's really expensive to send people out to measure the roofs up and design it and give people a quote. And every time I give a quote, I get, you know, 10 quotes for every one business, right? And so what they've done is they're using GIS technology, like just using really basic satellite pictures, et cetera, to work out the angle of the roof and the sun and so on. They design it remotely in 15 minutes on the internet and email you the quote, right? And the cost that has come out of the system is so strong that they've gone from, I think he said they turned over $60 million last year. It'll be $120 million this year and $300 million next year. And within three or four years, they will be able to competitively put solar panels on people's and 60% of American houses, right, with no carbon price. So the point is, once we do actually take the action, the system is ready to really take off and do extraordinary things extraordinarily quickly, which is a good thing because we're going to have to do a lot of big things extraordinarily quickly.
Paul Gilding winding up that edited version of the Sydney Writers' Festival session called You Have Been Warned.